Hi, I'm Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. This week, we're going to be exploring the big question. What is this social innovation thing? And more to the point, what is good social innovation? We're going to explore what we've learned about social innovation at TACSI through doing it. We're going to explore Jeff Mulgan's thinking and his perspective from his book, Social Innovation, How Do Societies Find the Power to Change? And we're going to take a glimpse into First Nations-led social innovation in Australia today. This podcast is being recorded on unceded Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future, and to acknowledge the traditional custodians on the lands on which you're listening.
So the Australian Centre for Social Innovation was established late in 2009 with seed funding from the South Australian Government. We exist to identify and support innovative ideas, methods and people to accelerate positive social change. In that sense, we're more of a do tank than a think tank. We see ourselves as a laboratory to test out and find ideas that we believe will help generate better social outcomes.
So TACSI is an acronym for the Australian Centre for Social Innovation. But what does that social innovation bit actually mean? Back in 2009, TACSI was started with $6 million of seed funding from the South Australian Government and a really broad remit. The idea for TACSI first appeared in Jeff Mulgan's report called Social Innovation in 360 Degrees, and it was written as part of his Adelaide Thinker in Residence residency. He wrote that a new centre should be created that would, and I'm quoting here, support and orchestrate practical social innovation, that it should be initially focused on social policy, and that the centre itself should also become a centre for knowledge and learning across Australia. Now, what that report didn't say is how to do that, and how to do that was really left up to the team and the board at the time. So our first decade at TACSI was very much a live exploration of what social innovation could and should be. TACSI's very first project was something called the Bold Ideas Better Lives Challenge. TACSI asked Australia, what do you think the big problems are facing your society and what can you do to solve them? And we offered a $1 million prize fund taken from our own seed funding to be shared amongst the winning entries and support from TACSI as well. Part of the idea was to raise the profile of social innovation. Part of the idea was to get a sense of what was out there in Australia. The 250 entries were whittled down to 12 winners based on those that were the most innovative, impactful, and implementable. There was investment into social enterprise in the APY lands. Perhaps the most well-known investment was then into a fledgling ethical toilet roll company, a company named Who Gives a Crap. Another was into something called Hello Sunday Morning, a campaign, a movement to address binge drinking amongst young people. Another was into Renew Australia, who make creative use of vacant buildings. And interestingly, looking back at those entries, many of the themes they covered are continued in our work today at TACSI: Indigenous self-determination, disability, ageing, mental health, connecting communities. Although we haven't done anything in toilets for a while. The entries did give us an indication of the breadth of social innovation. And who does it? For the Bold Ideas Challenge, social innovation was about furthering existing projects, often social purpose businesses and local programs.
Hi, I'm Peter Shergold, and for 5 years I headed up the Prime Minister's Department until 3 years ago I moved out to set up a Centre for Social Impact. And we work really closely with the Australian Centre for Social Innovation. I've got to say, here in South Australia, TACSI, as we know them, are doing really innovative work in what I think is one of the most important areas of public policy now, which is how we move from those who get government services being seen as beneficiaries and recipients of actually involving them in taking control of their lives, of engaging citizens. This isn't about new ways of service delivery. This is about new radical approaches to policy design. And I'd have to say the work that's been going on here in giving family-to-family support for those families who are disadvantaged, the work that's now going to be done on applying those philosophies and methodologies to the age is really at the cutting edge. I see a movement in Australia now to look at and embrace these new ways of doing governance. And in my view, TACSI and South Australia is right at the forefront of that.
The second major project TACSI was to invest in was to start a radical redesign team. This is when I joined, about 3 months after TACSI had started for proper. And it was probably the first time I'd really heard social innovation used regularly as a way to describe a way of working and an intent. We hadn't used that in the organisations I'd worked in the UK at Participle or RED, where we'd framed the work much more as building the next generation of public services.
My name's Carolyn Curtis, and I'm part of the Radical Redesign team here at the Australian Centre for Social Innovation. I've spent the last 12 months developing the project that we now have, Family by Family. Before that, I worked for our state's Child Protection Service for the past 10 years in a range of different roles in a social work capacity. Some of the biggest things that are different when you come to work at TACSI and become part of the Radical Redesign team is the space and the time that's allowed here to create and explore things that are quite different, that sit outside the community and social work sphere, things that feel quite uncomfortable, and things that you would often never think about trying. We incorporate design. And my first day on the job, I went and sat at McDonald's and learned all about the design of McDonald's and what worked and what didn't, but we actually break down interactions and actually look at what we can do to make an interaction work better and who does what and who says what and try and script those things out. We take an ethnographic approach as opposed to using traditional assessment methodologies. So we spend time with people. We don't go in with a structured set of questions or agenda that we need to sort of answer before we leave. We let families and people set their agenda, and we just immerse ourselves in their space to understand them, what they do, what works, what doesn't work for them. And I guess the other really significant thing for me here coming to TACSI was this whole concept of prototyping. Which I probably would have before said, oh yeah, that's just a pilot. But prototyping really is quite different. It's quick, it's short, it's fast moving, it's frustrating, but very effective. So as quickly as you're making new materials and trying out new ways of interacting, talking with people and having conversations, you're throwing those things out and starting again. So it's about finding the right fit as opposed to picking something and sticking with it and forcing it to work.
The aim of the Radical Redesign team was to demonstrate that design-based methodologies can make meaningful progress on long-standing social challenges. With Sarah Shulman, now of In With Forward in Canada, I brought the design-based methodologies we'd been using in the UK, working with Hilary Cottam at Participle, and before that as part of the RED team at the UK Design Council.
Hi, my name is Sarah Shulman. I'm one of the co-leads of our Radical Redesign team. I've got a background in social policy, community development, human biology, and education. And all of that different stuff comes together in our work on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's one of the things that makes our jobs quite different from traditional policy jobs or traditional research jobs. We're blending all sorts of different ideas at one time, and we're making stuff really real. So I used to work for big governments and help them to run engagement processes with people. So that meant big consultations, focus groups, interviews, those sorts of things. And what always frustrated me about that work was it was disconnected from stuff on the ground. We'd pull people into rooms to hear what they had to say, but we had no idea how they actually behaved or acted outside of those rooms. And so our work takes us out of boardrooms, takes us out of meeting rooms, and into people's homes and into the community, where we can really get a better understanding of people's behavior in real time, and then learn how to shape that behavior into practice and policy that actually works.
The brief for the first radical redesign project was sourced by asking the South Australian government to name their most intractable problem, with the slightly audacious idea that we could then show how this new design-based approach could lead to progress against that problem. What was the toughest problem that nobody was making progress on? Well, it was child protection. And so we started the Family Project. The project asked the question, how can we enable more families to thrive and fewer to come into expensive state-provided crisis support services, like child protection services? And it's through this project that Carolyn Curtis joined our team and we developed Family by Family. Family by Family was only ever designed to be what families wanted and needed, to be a radical demonstration of what was possible. So it was great surprise that it quickly got funding to run as an actual service, and now it's scaling in the UK. Coming to Australia from the UK, I distinctly remember at the time thinking that Family by Family would never work in the UK because of the cultural differences around helping others. I think it's too early to tell, but I'm pretty sure that I was wrong about that.
So my name is Jess DeCampo, and I've been invited along for a spot of filming today to share a little bit about my background and how I came to Taxi and my experience of co-design since I've been here. So I started out work-wise working as a teacher in high schools, and so I worked in both Melbourne and then up in Darwin in the Northern Territory. And that was something that I loved a great deal and was really passionate about the kids that I worked with. But I ultimately ended up leaving teaching because I felt like, although I could have a really good impact with the 20 kids that were directly in front of me in any given class, I had absolutely no influence on the whole range of other things that were directly impacting the way that those kids walked into my classroom. I felt like I was sort of too zoomed in, I suppose. And then so I went from there to working in research and policy because I really wanted to zoom out and to perhaps have a chance to look at some of those broader issues that affect kids and young people and their kind of life outcomes. And I think whilst, again, I really enjoyed that and found it really stimulating, I also felt like in that world of research and policy, you're often so disconnected, you're so zoomed out from kids and families, that a lot of the stuff that you spend time thinking about and writing about and the ideas that you're coming up with never trickled back down to those kids and families in a way that's actually going to be really useful for them. And I think as well, because you're working in such a bubble often in that sort of research and policy world, a lot of the same sorts of ideas keep circulating and you're not coming up necessarily with new or perhaps even more effective or interesting ways to get at some of those tricky issues. And so I think what drove me to come to Taxi was the opportunity to, I suppose, both be zoomed in and zoomed out. And I think that that's really uniquely what co-design offers. So in terms of being zoomed in, it's the opportunity to spend days with people in their context and learning from them and seeing how their day-to-day unfolds, which is such a rich and unique way to learn. And then the opportunity to take a lot of those insights that people have shared with you about their day-to-day and try and think about how could those things that you've learned in context be applied perhaps at a broader scale or be part of a new solution that might create change for those people that you've spent time with.
After developing Family by Family, the Radical Redesign team expanded. We hired and trained new people who were new to social innovation, and that work in that year was focused on great living in later life, and from that came Weavers. So social innovation for the Radical Redesign team was working with people to define the solutions they wanted and needed and demonstrating what was possible, all underpinned by a design-based methodology. But for the Family by Family team, which was now led by Carolyn, social innovation meant taking the prototype into something real. Social innovation was about operationalising big ideas.
My name is Rihanna.
We're the Scene Family.
My name is Fate.
My name is Tia.
My name is Noshin.
I'm Ashley, and this is my daughter Heidi.
Hi, I'm Tanya.
I'm AJ, and this is
Trinity.
And Connor.
Hi, I'm Mel.
We're the Dawkins family.
Hi, we're the Royal Family.
Family by Family is a new network of families helping families. We're not judgmental, we're not a religious organisation, we're not a political organisation, and we're not a government organisation.
There's no catches to it, there's no nothing, it's all real.
It was about maintaining those big ideas whilst building an organisation and a system to deliver them. Keeping the focus on intent and vision whilst also setting up things like employment contracts, phone contracts, making sure that everything we were doing was legal and that the money added up at the end of the month.
Hi, my name is Carol Gravisa and I'm project manager at Dome. I've just been to a great workshop on co-designing.
So more and more organisations have been asking us to help them get better at doing co-design. So we're starting a new initiative at Taxi to do just that. And our first step is a series of workshops.
We actually had a taste of what the process of co-designing is. So we had an overview about what it's for. We actually saw some case studies about how people use co-designing. And then in the afternoon, we had quite an accelerated approach to co-design.
So who's it for? Well, it's for program managers, executive, entrepreneurs, innovators, basically anyone who's charged with improving or developing new services and programs and is passionate about creating better outcomes for people.
As the seed funding for Taxi was spent, we started to explore how we could support other social purpose organisations to do social innovation. And critically, how to get paid for doing that. And whilst that seed funding running out caused, you know, a fair share of cold sweats and near-death moments, it may have just been one of the best things to ever happen to Taxi, because it really focused us to discover the social innovation that people would actually pay for, and it forced us to start to integrate social innovation practice with mainstream systems. We had to ask, what is it that governments, NGOs, and philanthropy saw value in? What would they actually put their hands in their pockets to fund? And we did some pretty experimental things to learn that. I remember that one of our first external capability building experiences was teaching federal government employees prototyping and inductive logic through the live prototyping of cocktails with real alcohol. At that time, Australia had a relatively shallow market for social innovation, and I guess you could say that it still has a relatively shallow market. And I sort of think of us as a seed that might be blown onto an inhospitable, windy cliff. We're to really sort of spread out our roots and to seek out the nutrients that could sustain us and to help us grip on through those early days. But what that meant is that we got to explore a lot of different territories and we got to do a lot of different kinds of work. A few years back, the New School in New York City conducted some research, and as part of it, they asked social innovation labs how many projects they do a year. Taxi had done about 100 that year, but that was about 3 times more than the next busiest social innovation lab. So Taxi's social innovation work is particularly broad. With a team of around 30 people, we're one of the biggest social innovation-only labs. And with a lifespan of about 11 years, we're one of the oldest now. Now, these volume of work and longevity are all pretty crude measures, really. But I think this gives an indication of the breadth of experience we've got to draw on to inform this course. So what is social innovation? Well, one take on it from our experience is that it's inclusive of social enterprise and social purpose business and local scale innovations, as the challenge entrants were. But it's also about demonstrating radical new possibilities, like the work of the Radical Redesign team. It's about putting ideas into practice, and it's about implementation, like Family by Family and Weavers. But it's also about working with mainstream systems, including government, building their capability and tackling policy problems through government and through work with not-for-profit service providers. What's good social innovation? Well, looking back over our work at Taxi a few years ago, we saw 3 things that were always present in the work that really got results. The work was systemic, that is, it paid attention to the bigger picture. The work was centered around people, and that often meant that it was participatory in nature. And the work was experimental. That is, we learnt through doing, drawing on rigor and creativity, evidence and learning. And it's those three things in combination, systemic, human, experimental, that form the core of this course.
And the next keynote speaker up on stage, those of you who were here this morning, you've already met him. It's the ideas man, who likes to call himself the invisible facilitator. For many years, this man has been in the front line of innovation policy as a pioneer thinker, author, and advisor. He's also been involved in research, in policy making, and shaping the way that UK does social innovation. Don't miss his recent book, which is called Social Innovation: How Societies Find the Power to Change. So let's hear this Nestor's reflection on the development of social innovation from the past and all the way into future scenarios. Please welcome Jeff Margan.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, so I meant to dance. Yeah, you don't want to see me dancing, I promise you that. So, thank you for the invitation to be here. I first came to Malmo, I realized, just over
social innovation years, covers a lot of theoretical ground. Point, it covers a lot of different disciplines. It's very eclectic. Perhaps that's the reason why there are so few books that give a meaningful overview of the discipline or the movement. It's not an easy one to tackle. And one of the few books that attempt to do that is the 2019 book Social Innovation: How Communities Find the Power to Change by Jeff Mulgan, the founding father of Taxi, if you like.
And there's a story I can tell today, which is in some ways quite an optimistic story. And I should warn you, I'm going to start optimistic, then I'm going to go pessimistic, and then I'll try and go optimistic again. But this is, you know, the optimistic story says that in the last 10 or 15 years, the social innovation field, which you're all part of, has become a lot more organized. There's a lot more money flowing into it, some from government, some from impact investors. There are things like social impact bonds and agencies like Vinnova here or Citra in Finland, you know, have now programs of social innovation, which they didn't have 15 years ago. We've also seen national power involved. Again, we talked about this morning. Governments from Malaysia to Korea with social innovation strategies. Justin Trudeau, who's just been re-elected in Canada, has committed $1 billion to social innovation funds. And a lot, we heard about this morning from the European Commission. The university world has got involved with research centers, courses of all kinds. You can see a little bit, summarized there. And then there's still the grassroots energy of a whole series of overlapping movements like the maker movement, open science, data, and so on, all, I think, contributing new energy. So that's the optimistic story of the last 10 or 15 years, but I think it's kind of obvious that's not the whole story. In other respects, we are sort of winning some battles, perhaps losing some wars. That's very obvious at a political level, where, you know, we have this bunch of people, I guess they are, who hate everything you stand for. I mean, they hate the idea of citizens taking control of social change. They believe it's their job, and in different ways, from Russia to Turkey to Brazil, to Hungary, they are squeezing the space for civil society in very aggressive ways, which I think we didn't predict a decade ago. The other kind of negative story, which we hinted at this morning, is really about R&D. If you look at the R&D world, and this is a chart showing different countries spending with the big spenders here, Denmark, Finland, Sweden there, Korea, Japan, No, there is more and more money flowing into R&D, but the percentage of that going to social innovation is still minuscule in all of these countries. And indeed, if you look around the world, the what I call the 20th century hierarchy, which was really established by the US and the Soviet Union in the middle of the last century, that still survives. And this guy, Vannevar Bush, probably created it. And it still means that for any new technology, it's first of all used for the military. Half of all US public R&D funding still goes to the military. Then, you know, big companies come in. And then only much, much later do we look at whether there's a social need which could be served by AI, drones, any emerging technologies. That hierarchy is still really fixed in our systems. And that means the world's brain power is still massively, I think, distorted, far more directed to better ways of killing people or better ways of doing things like click through advertising rather than attending to things like loneliness or long-term unemployment. So, as a result, I think the big imbalances are still pretty much there in terms of our social energies, our brain power is much less directed to issues of refugees or climate change or isolation than to all sorts of other either harmful or trivial needs. So, that's the pessimistic sort of account of where we are in the present. So what might be the story of the next few years, and what are some things...
Jeff opens the book with a description of accelerating interest and activity in social innovation in the first two decades of the 21st century. He characterises it as an extension of social innovations in the 19th and 20th centuries. I'm going to read a little bit of the first chapter here. He's talking here about what happened in the 19th and 20th centuries around social innovation. Social generativity and growth was constrained essentially by a lack of organisation, not imagination. So ideas failed to develop and flourish. What this meant was an uneven capacity to create viable futures, to imagine, to try out and grow ideas, whether small or large. The social world of civil society instead saw a constant stream of lost futures, conceived but never born, imagined but never built. Other fields, from physics to space exploration, from banking to retail, by contrast, had access to the means to nurture and grow their ideas and their visions of the future. This imbalance remains very visible today. Contrast, for example, the huge sums invested in technology-driven visions of the future smart city with the meagre investment in future visions that are motivated by notions of social value. So what's social innovation to Jeff? His preferred definition is that social innovations are innovations that are social both in their ends and their means. And it so happened that a version of this definition appeared on the very first taxi website. And it's sort of the high-level definition that we'll use in this course. Jeff says that social innovations are social in their ends because they are motivated by the goal of meeting a social need. They're social in their means because they leave behind a stronger social capacity to act and are usually, though not exclusively, spread through organisations whose primary purposes are social. Jeff describes how social innovations spiral out from the heat and passion of ideas and experimentation into the cooler world of implementation, institutions, and laws. And I think that movement from hot to cool is a very interesting observation. He notes how social innovation spans across four different economies. The grant economy, for example, philanthropically funded work, the state, government-funded work, the market, social purpose business, and the household. And I think that household economy deserves some further exploration. And I understand it to be that sometimes social innovation takes people investing their personal time, money, and energy in socially innovative practices. For example, this week in Australia, we've seen women protest across the country to call for an end to sexual violence and discrimination in the workplace. I, as a man, was asked to notice and call out misogyny by male colleagues. And that's something that I'm going to have to invest in personally. Taxi's Future of Home initiative calls on all Australians to rethink their notions of what a good home is and how to live in later life. Another example, the Uluru Statement from the Heart calls on all Australians to be better allies to First Nations Australians. Jeff's book also includes some cautions. He cautions against heroism, pointing to one person as the social innovator. He sees social innovation as a team sport involving lots of people to make any meaningful change happen. He also cautions against solutionism, the naive belief that social innovation or social innovations can solve social problems. But he believes we should do it, and really what they'll contribute to is resolving social problems. He concludes that whilst it builds on what it's gone before, social innovation at a global level is in an embryonic state. And I'll finish with this quote. See if this rings true for you. The practice of social innovation remains roughly at the point where science was more than a century ago, when invention and innovation were left to the enthusiasm and energy of determined innovators, like Alexander Graham Bell, who beavered away in their laboratories until the occasional eureka moment gave the world a new invention. Wouldn't it be good if we weren't so far behind? Jeff's account is global in perspective and broad-ranging, but he doesn't present a view of social innovation from a First Nations perspective. And I think that's a critical dimension to any social innovator working on colonised lands. Jeff describes social innovation as giving power to people to address their own issues. And I think the ongoing process of colonisation could be described as the opposite of this, something that takes power away, something distinctly antisocial in means and in ends, something that leaves people with fewer opportunities to shape their own lives. There's much to be learnt from the diversity of First Nations-led social innovation. Compared to non-Indigenous social innovators in Australia, First Nations social innovators have to overcome greater degrees of injustice whilst walking in two worlds and experiencing racism. But they do this backed by a knowledge system that is inherently systemic, relational, and sustainable. Knowledge about how to live in Australia developed over at least 75,000 years of continuous culture. Perhaps the most prominent set of First Nations innovation at this point in time is the Uluru Statement from the Heart. The participatory processes that led to its creation, the proposed societal and constitutional innovations, and the campaigns and initiatives to bring those innovations into being. This is Professor Megan Davis, who's going to explain the process. She's a constitutional lawyer and a Cobble Cobble Aboriginal woman from the Burungum Nation in southwest Queensland.
So I'm just going to say a few things about those dialogues and then move on to the reforms. We say that this dialogue process is unprecedented in Australian history. There's never been such a process that has involved convened for and hosted by First Nations people on constitutional reform. I mentioned from the outset that, of course, because of the funding, we couldn't speak to all 600,000 people, but we engaged a sample of 1,200 people from 12 of those dialogues, and as I said, 60% of the invite list was traditional owners, so most of those regions had done some consultation prior to that meeting through the Land Council on the constitutional reforms. Every dialogue was run the same way, in exactly the same way, because it had to be, to ensure that everybody received the same information. We based a lot of the structure of the 2 days on the Constitutional Centenary Framework, a foundation framework. And we had the same kind of principles at every single dialogue. It needed to be impartial. The relevant information had to be accessible. There needed to be open and constructive dialogue and mutually agreed and owned outcomes. So in relation to the relevant information being accessible, that was of course difficult. Pat Anderson engaged a number of ANU linguists and translated the dialogue papers into about 12 to 13 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages, and including taping short vignettes and videos on the different reforms. But of course, it's difficult. It's still difficult. In Ross River, we had four different interpreters interpreting the dialogue, which meant the legal lecture we ran, which was normally about 2 hours, went for almost 5 hours. Having said that, Ross River probably did have the deepest comprehension of the legal reforms by the end of that process. So everything was run precisely the same way in terms of its structure. So in terms of the structure, we had to open up by having the conversation I've just had with you about recognition. So one of the first things that would happen is people objected to recognition full stop and objected to recognise. So we would have to talk about and explain, of course, the legal and political complexity around this concept recognition, and ask people to just simply think about it as reform. So I worked with Rachel Perkins and we developed a very important film, a short film, that explained that history of reform advocacy of our mob since 1840, so that we were able to frame the debate and take the heat off this word recognition and just talk about constitutional reform. We did have to build in quite a lengthy third day to be able to deal with the important ventilation that happened from each of the regions about the state of their communities and the state of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs. So we built in that extra day so that Saturday and Sunday we could just focus on the Constitution. But that first day was really important because that's where the history story comes from. So the two key things people spoke about, the first one was truth-telling. So everybody wanted to talk about the true history of Australia and the stories in their regions from before the invasion to after the invasion, to the period of massacres or frontier wars or killings, to the era of compulsory racial segregation, the reserves and missions that I think Ron referred to in his beautiful Welcome to Country, the assimilation period where we saw removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, right through to the self-determination era and after. So the transcripts of the dialogues are quite an extraordinary record of some amazing people from around the country who spoke to this truth, including elders in a number of areas who were witness to massacres in their region. So we built that extra day in to be able to hear those stories and record those stories. That first day was really difficult. People feel voiceless and they feel powerless. And then when they travel to the cities or down to Canberra to lobby, they're told not to talk about it because it's deficit discourse. Don't even start me on that. If anyone raised deficit discourse in the dialogues, we would say this is law reform, this is hard-headed law reform. To do law reform, you've got to talk about what the problem is. That's not a deficit, you're just talking about the facts. And so what we heard from what were really on the ground, I know people hate to use this word, but the dialogues decided to reclaim it, grassroots communities, the voice is what they wanted. They wanted something that will empower them. They didn't want reserve seats or designated parliamentary seats because they'd seen what had happened in New Zealand and other places where those seats tend to become captive to party ideology. It's just the nature of liberal democratic governance. They don't know what the voice will look like, and we have, of course, argued to the government that that process has to happen after the referendum. You need to do a really forensic dialogue process with the communities to really understand how things are working now and what a voice would look like in those communities. But there is no surprise, if you know anything about the community, that this voice to Parliament was ranked one, and it was ranked above agreement-making and treaty-making. So the key point about treaty-making falling where it did is simply that a lot of communities said they weren't in a position to negotiate complex legal agreements. Most communities have no leverage. Most communities didn't get a very good deal out of native title. And one of the things they all said was that their communities were still fighting and families were still healing, and some families are still not talking to each other after that native title process. One of the things they did ask for was better dispute resolution services in communities to allow people to speak again. That's just one of the many reasons, but I thought it was quite a sophisticated position that the dialogues took with respect to agreement making. That they're just not some are ready, but there's not a lot of leverage when you're going in to negotiate with the Crown something like a treaty agreement. And then, of course, the final reform was truth. Truth wasn't an option we took out, of course. Truth-telling commission was not an option that was that we took out. And that's for it wasn't really on the table in terms of the reforms. But the communities also didn't ask for a national truth and reconciliation commission. So I know that post-Uluru, some people have come over the top and called for a national commission. That's not what the dialogue said. They spoke about localised truth-telling. The kind of truth-telling that they've already done through statutory land rights processes and native title processes, the kind of truth-telling that they do now with local councils and local historical societies. Nations were very adamant that they want to be controlled themselves of truth-telling in their nation, in their region, and they will feed that up to some national body, probably the Makarrata Commission, when they're ready.
This is an innovation for fundamental recognition and representation and self-determination over laws and policies that affect First Nations people. The ambition of this social innovation is to create change at a societal level, to shift the identity and the constitution of a nation and the relationship between First Nations and non-Indigenous Australians.
My work then has kind of been very focused on a nation-building approach to what was going on in my particular community, and I wasn't using the language nation-building at the time. That's come at a later date through some of the connections that we've made with other folk around the world, particularly coming out of here in the US, the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development, the work of the Native Nations Institute, the work of the University of Technology in Sydney and a number of colleagues there, plus some of the other work that I was engaging in through my own PhD studies in New Zealand at the University of Auckland with Maori colleagues who were again part of my education process.
The Nation Building Movement is an international movement of Indigenous peoples furthering self-determination by organising at a nation level within a nation state. In Australia, we can see that in the evolving governing systems of the Njarrindjeri Nation as just one example. They strategically engage their citizens to determine their futures. Former Taxi board member Daryl Rigney, a Njarrindjeri man and now a professor at UTS and also in Arizona, is a leading figure in this movement.
One of the responses to the whole Kumarank issue was that we were not very well organised as a Njarrindjeri community to respond quickly and effectively to the challenges that were put before us at that point in time. And in part that was a product of the history of the way things had developed in South Australia, but I would think actually across the country, Most of the organisations that had developed in our country, that you might call Ngarrindjeri in some way, shape or form, were essentially organisations designed to do particular and very directed things. So we had an organisation called Kauparin, which is a drug and alcohol organisation dealing with those particular issues. We had a health organisation dealing with those issues. We had a race relations and cultural education centre that dealt with teaching broader, teaching the schooling sector primarily about Ngarrindjeri people and educating them and connecting into the schooling sector. We had women's organisations. We had and so on. And they go on, and each of those were largely funded out of connections to the South Australian government and sometimes to the federal government, where they'd receive project planning funds or funds to run their organisations. And so there was this kind of disconnected in a formal political sense as a governing body representing the nation. Having said that, though, there was some key bodies that did do the representation around, the political representation for Ngarrindjeri. And they were in the Ngarrindjeri Native Title Management Committee, because the Native Title legislation required certain things to happen and certain conversations to happen, which meant we had a voice and a voice to government to speak. It also happened in relation to heritage, so the Ngarrindjeri Heritage Committee was a key organisation in doing that. And so a lot of the political work and representation work occurred there, supported by our traditional governing system, we call it a tendi. And the head of the tendi is known as the Rupali, and that group of people, the chairs of those three organisations, were effectively the leadership to the nation. And so what they, one of the lessons learned out of the HIMARS experience is that we needed to try and bring the nation together in a better way than what it had been. Partly in order to stop the way some of the processes that rolled out from, say, heritage legislation. Heritage legislation meant that you could have an issue and that whoever was dealing with that from the government end would go out and talk to whomever they chose or whomever elected to give some kind of representation around whatever that issue might be. So it could talk to 10 people, 100 people, 1,000 people, and it tended to cherry pick the responses that it most wanted to work with as a result of that. And so what part of the idea was that in terms of protecting yourself was to narrow the voice, narrow this, not in terms of the expansiveness of the ideas, but the process about where you get a Ngarrindjeri position on a key issue like a heritage issue. And that Ngarrindjeri would take the responsibility, as it always had done, for providing that response. It was not for the government to go and have a series of conversations and form its response in the absence of a organised response from the Ngarrindjeri nation. So what we did was to pull together those disparate parts, who had all had their own powers and were all kind of reluctant to give that up, the idea of coming under a body like what we eventually named the political entity, which is the Ngarrindjeri Regional Authority. Okay, we're happy to think about joining the regional authority, but you're not going to tell us what to do. And so, it's like, no, we respect your authority, we respect your autonomy, but we need to act more broadly in the interests of the nation, and this is the way to do it. And that was accepted over time, and so we formed the regional authority in July of 2007, and that became the representative voice. That then allowed us to think about, well, what does it mean to be a nation?
So the focus of social innovation in nation building is about forms of governance at a nation level. Daryl talks about how developing the Ngarrindjeri nation as a political and as a legal entity has enabled his people to better fight developments on their traditional land, to support repatriation of the bones of their old people from museums around the world, to create a shared view on traditional Ngarrindjeri cultural knowledge, which was fractured by colonisation, and to develop a Ngarrindjeri economy to break reliance on short-term government funding. When Taxi worked for the Anakarina Matu Yunkjunk Jara Aboriginal Corporation, they were particularly interested in how more Aboriginal businesses could help them move their people out of poverty in Coober Pedy. we commissioned the Jimbana Institute, the Indigenous-led research institute at UTS, to provide a global perspective on how Indigenous communities are developing their economies to provide routes out of poverty and into prosperity. Jimbana pointed to the various roles of business at the intersection of commercial enterprise, meeting social needs, and cultural activity. In this case, social innovation is business that leads to economic development and economic self-determination.
Young Aboriginal offenders are 28 times more likely than non-Indigenous youth to end up in juvenile detention. Now a new program is hoping to change that. The state's first Koori Court will begin hearing cases in Western Sydney in the new year. Alan Clark has this exclusive story.
Rex Sorby. Aboriginal elder Uncle Rex Sorby has had enough of watching young Indigenous people being locked up in juvenile detention.
I've saw people coming from court, Aboriginal children, lost Aboriginal children right through New South Wales.
Mr Sorby is one of several elders who will work with young Aboriginal offenders in the state's first ever Koori Court. Announced by the Attorney General today, the court will begin hearing cases in Parramatta from January for a 12-month trial.
If they can become an active participant with Aboriginal elders and the court, and understand that they can, in their own hands, hold their future, then we've made a difference.
Koori Courts, also known as circle sentencing, are already operating in Victoria and the ACT.
In the early 2000s, the Koori Justice Caucus, a group of Aboriginal leaders, and the Koori Justice Unit, a government unit, created the Koori Court system in Victoria. The court is for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who have taken responsibility and pleaded guilty to a criminal offence. And it's been designed to reflect cultural issues and operate in a more informal way.
The process allows Aboriginal elders and victims to participate in informal court hearings. The participants can then suggest sentencing options to the magistrate, with detention as a last resort.
In a Koori court, the magistrate, offenders and the elders would sit at a table like this, face to face. And elders say that would have much more of an impact on young Aboriginal offenders.
Kooris represent just over 2% of the New South Wales population, but make up 60% of those in juvenile detention.
There ends up to be a point where you can no longer say that any of these programs or any of these alternative orders have worked.
If successful, Koori courts will be rolled out across the state. Alan Clark, ABC News.
And the evaluations of this approach show its effectiveness in reducing recidivism. So here, social innovation is about creating and proving the effectiveness of culturally specific alternatives to mainstream systems for First Nations people. And Koori Courts are just one example of many innovations in justice and education in early childhood, to name a few. And more recently, TACSI worked with the Koori Caucus to develop Aboriginal Justice Strategy 4. And part of that is to expand on the idea of Koori courts by laying the foundations for a parallel legal system for Aboriginal people.
So what I'd like to touch on now is the project in developing the child and family support system. And how we thought about encouraging Aboriginal voices to be at the centre of this. It was a whole stream of work in developing this, and we went through a series of processes. We developed a series of co-design principles, of which I'll share tonight, and also some design criteria, which I'll touch on briefly, but I thought what would be most useful tonight would be think about the principles of co-design and how we think about how we need to respect and walk alongside Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities to create opportunities for systemic change. So we had a series of workshops. This included a range of different professionals and stakeholders, including a number of Aboriginal professionals. We spoke with families. So this was a mainstream project. It involved all sorts of communities, but this also included speaking very specifically to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families as well. And ensuring that they played a key role in what happened and the design of the outcomes. We talked about, and I used a methodology, which I suppose is about speculating about an alternative future. a different scenario, really to awaken ideas and ways of thinking that were hopeful for our peoples. And sometimes that's it's harder to be hopeful in some of our communities because things can get so hard, but I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. And then, of course, what I ensured and made sure happened in this project was that the concept of First Nations ways of being, doing and knowing was stamped onto every part of the project. And the link that I shared earlier, and I'm sure that Jax can share afterwards, that is the summary report. And you can have a look at how Aboriginal ways of being, doing, knowing, speaking actually infuses all parts of that project.
And maybe mainstream services and policies can learn something from this Indigenous-specific programs and policies too. Dana Shen certainly thinks so. She's a social innovator, a former public servant, a former director of Taxi's Family by Family program, and an Aboriginal Chinese woman who's a descendant of the Ngurundjeri people. And when we worked together, I was always taken in by her idea of adopting First Nation-specific innovations for mainstream services. And she had a great name for it. She called it Nunga Streaming, and really talked about its applicability for families in health and human services.
So a different scenario. So this is what I read out to people in professional stakeholder workshops, asked people to close their eyes, and lots of Aboriginal people were involved in this. This is a system that was built by us from the ground up for our people. It closed the gap some time ago. Actually, the rest of the community are starting to use our models and ways of working because they know it came from 65,000 years of knowledge and strength and has been built with deep wisdom and connection with the world. They know they are missing out on something. This is all ours. So this was an invitation to see our community and our world from our eyes, totally. People were invited to do artwork, poetry, all sorts of creative ways in order to express that. And you'll see some of those things in the reports that are online. It was a starting point really to look at finding a central point where our lens was the main lens and to provide hope and possibilities.
The country was well managed and there was a lot of grasslands and healthy landscapes, and that was important because animals depend on the grasses and the grasses are there for seeds and food. When the settlers came to Australia, it changed immediately by taking fire out of the landscape completely. And so what was going on for thousands of years of people looking after the land, suddenly it just stopped.
When the old people got their land back through the native title claim, it was still classified as national park. They weren't really allowed to put fire on the land.
George and Tommy would be like, you know, we got to burn. You know, the land's so unbalanced and so sick. When we drove around on their country, they were heartbroken. They were seeing weeds and dead grass over the bonnet of the car, and, you know, they couldn't find places. They couldn't recognise their land. Eventually, one day, the same thing happened, and I said, burn it, old fellow, why don't you just burn? And then he said, all right then, let's do it. We lit the grass and ran tiptoeing back into the truck and closed the door, and we looked at the fire, it just started taking off, and our hearts were beating, and we knew we were in trouble straight away. We just knew we were in trouble for doing that.
Just heard Victor Stephenson from the Fire Sticks Alliance talking there on the Australian story. One of the things to grow from the terrible Australian bushfires in the summer of 2019 and 2020 was a newfound understanding amongst white people of the relevance of traditional knowledge systems and practices, specifically Indigenous fire management practices. The Fire Sticks Alliance is one example of how traditional knowledge is being rekindled through research, through sharing practice nationally between Aboriginal organisations and with non-Indigenous organisations, as well as by providing fee-for-service support. The author and farmer Bruce Pascoe wrote recently about how those bushfires spread through his farm in Victoria and led to the regrowth of dancing grass, which he and his team have now harvested and milled into flour and baked into bread. Bruce Pascoe sets forth a vision in which Indigenous grains and Indigenous agricultural knowledge give rise to a new movement of Aboriginal-led farms in Australia. It's the practical continuation of his research work and writing that's focused on shining a light on traditional Aboriginal agricultural practices.
Well, we estimated last year there was something like 85 grains that we thought we could recognise that Aboriginal people had used. It's now at least 120, and someone told me about one yesterday that I hadn't even heard of, hadn't even suspected. So this is the start of a real Australian agriculture, because many of these grains, and decompositum is one of them, grows on sand, needs one watering only. That's why those people in Central Australia were using the stream bed, because they sowed directly into the damp soil. They didn't need fertiliser because they were looking after the condition of the soil. And this is the threshold of a new agriculture in Australia, in a country where water shortage is going to get worse. And I think one of the reasons why we never wanted to consider Aboriginal foods, because it reminded us of the war. Because if we recognised the Aboriginal economy, we'd also have to recognise that the dispossession was illegal.
This revival and recontextualising of traditional knowledge into contemporary settings also flows through the work and the philosophy of Tyson Yunkaporta, Porter, who in his book Sand Talk seeks to show how Indigenous thinking can save the world.
Our cultures are adaptive in this way. They always have been. But what is the nature of that adaptivity? Because it's something we're going to need coming into this Anthropocene. We need, and people are calling for, a new way of being, as if this is something that we can design and that will emerge, and that we can then freeze that system in place again and try and keep as much as of much of this as possible. But what we're really looking at is having to develop, to co-evolve cultures of transition during a period of transition that is going to last for quite a while, centuries. Yeah, the emergent cultures for a few centuries are going to have to be cultures of transition that are transitioning us from one era to the next. Because the world that's coming out of this Anthropocene is not going to look very much like the world that went in. That doesn't mean it's not going to be amazing and lovely, by the way. I'm sure we'll get it to that point.
Tyson Yunkaporta is now developing the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Lab at Deakin University. He says the lab will be a place where Indigenous thinking can be applied to the issues that complexity scientists and technologists are currently working on across economics, design, cybernetics, governance, evolutionary dynamics, environment, cognition, and consciousness. Constitutional law reform, nation building, social purpose business, Indigenous-specific responses, Noongar streaming, reviving traditional knowledge, and applying Indigenous knowledge to contemporary problems. These are just a few glimpses into what First Nations social purpose innovation in Australia looks like today. It's certainly an incomplete view, and it's not featured the thousands of innovators working in communities and often working to create change without any recognition or profile. The focus here has been on First Nations-led social innovation, but the other side of that coin is the innovation within non-Indigenous organisations to create the time, the space and the resources to enable this great stuff to happen, creating the enabling conditions, and that might include getting out of the way. Thank you. One of my favourite gifts from a colleague is something that Ryan Hubbard, a member of the Radical Redesign team and a taxi associate, gave me on the occasion of my fifth taxi birthday. It's a small black plastic trophy and it sits above my desk at taxi. And it's the sort of trophy you might win if you came third place in a three-legged race at a community fair. It's not the most prestigious of trophies. It's not the FA Cup or the Ashes. But on that little imitation brass plaque is a white sticker, and on it, written in biro, is "Here's to 5 years of making it up." And I'm attached to it because it reminds me that when it comes to social innovation, that's what you've really got to do as a social innovation practitioner. Yes, we've got to build on the knowledge that's already there, and we've got to use that and talk to our smart colleagues, but we've also got to make stuff up. Because as far as I'm aware, no one is yet reporting a 100% success rate with a particular social innovation methodology. And nobody probably ever will, but I think that's a good aspiration to have. We've got to find the stuff, the ways of working that are going to work more effectively than the approaches we're currently taking. And I think you can only really do that through a significant amount of practice. In our work at Taxi, we've continually worked to establish and intentionally undo and then intentionally re-establish our own understanding of what social innovation could and should be. And I guess this Finzi course is one part of that tradition. We've experienced firsthand that social innovation can and needs to be lots of different things. We see others leading types of social innovation we've not yet practiced. And at the same time, we're certain that there's more to be invented out there. So I hope you can take some strange comfort in knowing that social innovation is incredibly broad. There are more practices and disciplines involved that you could possibly and reasonably expect to get good at in your lifetime. And what's more, there's lots still to be made up, and you could play a role in that.